Hi, this is Bradley, and welcome to Music Matters. Music Matters is a weekly podcast featuring the musical memories, in-depth discussions, and miscellaneous meanderings of Walden Miller and Lenny Melamedes. Essentially, two old guys talking about their love of all things music. But before we get to our great musical discussion, we would like to thank our sponsor of today's podcast. It's one of our favorites, Carboy Wine. Carboy Wine works hands-on with vineyards and winemakers from around the world. They source only the highest quality grapes, juice, and single varietal wines that is then vinted, blended, and aged to craft their select brand of Carboy Wine. Find out more about Carboy Wines at www.carboywines.com or head down to one of Angelo's Taverna locations. One is on 6th Avenue in Denver, Colorado, or the other on Santa Fe in Littleton. So let's get started. Music Matters format is simple and straightforward. Each week we will feature a different, somewhat predetermined topic. I will select a single, theme, question, genre, notion, or what have you from our pool of topics, and then turn these two guys loose. What happens next? Well, you're just going to have to stick around for the next half hour and find out.
So before we get too far down the road, let's meet our two old guys who love to talk about all things music, Walden Miller and Lenny Melamedes. Hey, good morning, guys.
Hey, good morning.
So let's get a little background on you two. Walden, let's start with you. What's the hook? What got you into this love of music?
Well, going back to my childhood, this is how all origins...
100 years ago?
Yes, how all origin stories start...
X-Men origins.
Thank you. There's never been a time in the house that I grew up in, or houses I've lived in since, where there hasn't been a ton of music playing all the time. Mm-hmm. And so when I grew up, I listened to one style of music, and that was primarily folk, rock, and musicals, because that's the music that was in my childhood home. Until I got old enough to buy my own albums, and whatnot, and I branched out into a variety of different. When I moved on and branched out, all that did is bring more music into the household. Mm-hmm. I still continued to listen to musicals. I still love musicals. I actually wrote a couple in my college career, and performed in them. But I also learned to play a lot of instruments. And this is the other part of my sort of musical history, I guess, is I started playing guitar before I started playing piano. I had this big folk, acoustic guitar that had the worst action ever, and it was steel strings. And so I just beat the crap out of my fingers. Mm-hmm. But I learned it was called a Chris guitar. Because my sister's...
We're going to blame Chris.
My sister's name was Chris, and so I remember it because it was a Chris guitar.
Is this a childhood issue with you? Yes. And your sister?
Oh, no. So she could play much better than I could at that time. But she taught me all of my first chords, and I remember my first chord was E minor because I only took two, fingers, and it was very easy. And you could play one song with just E minor. Oh, that was good. But I learned how to play guitar. Then I was forced by my parents to take piano lessons for about 10 years. So I played piano up through about, mid-high school or so. But I also had to play, I had to pick a band instrument. It's another one of those requirements. My parents were very big on forcing music on us. And neither one of them played any instruments, which is very interesting. My mom played a bugle in the bugle corps, which gives you an idea of...
Well, with all the kids in your house, she needed to play revelry.
Well, I found her bugle, and I still have it, and it's really cool because I can actually play. It's sitting right over there, as Bradley was pointing at it. But I learned how to play the bugle on my own. That was kind of fun. She had hidden it away someplace. I found it in the house. But I learned how to play French horn, trumpet, tuba, I learned to play stringed instruments, the flute, just a lot of different musicians' instruments.
But wait a second. Where'd you learn to play the harmonica? Where's the harmonica in that?
I did pick up the harmonica. There is a story there. I may hold that for a second. We'll come back to that. But I didn't learn how to play harmonica. I did convince my parents to buy me an electric guitar when I was about sixth grade or seventh grade. It was a Sears guitar, which is for those of you who can imagine this, it was a hard case, just like a nice hard case you'd see now for a guitar. You open it up, and the inside of the case was actually the speaker. So the amp, speaker, everything was built into the case, and you just plugged your guitar into the case, stood the case up, so that now it feels like you've got to stand up.
Was it also a washing machine at the same time?
No, but it was pretty funny. It looked like a Gibson Les Paul type guitar.
Les Paul wannabe.
Yeah, yeah. I said it looked like one. It didn't play like one. It played like a Sears guitar. It's like crappy sound, but it was only cost $25. So I was exceedingly happy because there's nothing like your first time. You plug in your guitar and you make noise. It's just like, very
didn't
nice.
Have 11 on that one.
Did not have it. Had two. Graduated like 0.1, 0.2.
That was the parents' edition of controlling the volume of the music.
Yeah, but it got me hooked on guitar. So I went on to learn how to play bass and learn how to play other instruments. But my best instrument, I think, still is my harmonica. I've played that in bands, and so my background as a musician is one thing. My
You're in a band.
Yeah, I should just go there. So thank you. I think the my first band was in
the Wiener Schnitzels, right?
It was in Germany, and it was called Altamont. It was a Rolling Stones cover band when I started.
Nobody died, right?
No one died that I know of. The good part about it was when I joined, they basically said, what can you sing? Because all they were playing was really Stones covers. They did a couple Grand Funk Railroad songs. And which is,
I'm your captain, baby.
No, they didn't do that. They all right, man. Now, And so I said, well, how about if we play some Canned Heat, maybe a little John Lee Hooker, maybe a little Muddy Waters? We could move into something where I can play harmonica with. And so we ended up doing Little Red Rooster and, a lot of different songs that I had fun singing and playing. And then
Butterfield?
No, none of his originals. We did a couple cover songs that he covered, as did Canned Heat, that were just old standards. Part of it was we had to find albums that they could listen to so that they could learn how to play the songs. And so this was actually kind of interesting. When you don't have the internet and you don't have radio stations that are playing what you want to play, you have to actually go buy albums. And one of the nicest things in Europe, certainly, which was different than in Des Moines, Iowa, where I'm from, is when you go to a record store there, you actually can play albums and listen to them before you buy them. So I would go in the afternoon and listen to songs for 4 hours. I wouldn't buy the album. I just would memorize all the lyrics, the whole works, write them down, and then give them back the album, say, that was great, and then walk out.
So wait a second. When you were growing up, you didn't have the music booth where they would let you go in with the album and listen to it. Or nowadays in the record store, where they plug in the headphone jack and have the sample.
That was a European, East Coast, maybe big city
East
thing
Coast,
only.
New York City, we had that.
Oh, I think probably Boston as well. But it was certainly never in the Midwest. The walking through the stacks was just...
Right.
Exactly that, and talking to the guy that runs the record store and say, you hold up a record and say, is this any good? And you get a yes or no answer, and who knows? And so you just buy it.
Well, they don't remember because they were too.
Yeah, well, I don't know about Des Moines is a hard place to grow up musically. I'll say that it was a challenge. On the other hand, I seem to do okay. But I was in a couple other bands, I should say. I started a couple other bands. It never went anywhere. One of them, we moved to Phoenix. That's where my first wife, Jennifer, she was the lead singer of the band. And we just...
What kind of music?
Oh, Patti Smith, Iggy Pop, Ramones, sort of punk, but new music, you know, rockabilly. It was a lot of different pieces. It was music that I liked to play. And that was the key is, do you like to play it? Okay, we're singing that. And so we did some covers. Most of the stuff, it was original compositions, but we didn't make it. So I ended up managing her band, her next band, which actually did pretty well in the Midwest. It was a regionally popular, regionally famous. It's called Cursing Birds. This was in 86, 87, at that downturn in the industry where nobody was signing new bands. It was just a hard time because of the CD industry came out in 85, 86, practically killed the music industry. They dropped bands left and right, so they weren't signing new bands. And so we got a lot of really nice handwritten letters from labels saying, you know, if you can...
Thank you, but no.
Thank you. If you can survive a couple more years, we'll be hiring. And it's like, bands can't survive a couple more years without having some sponsorship to tour. It just doesn't work. So that crashed and burned.
And pre-YouTube streaming.
Right.
Kind of... Resurgence.
It was all, we went to local, that was the birth, though, of the alternative labels, the small alternative labels. So we went to a lot of those in the mid-80s.
And the minibus bands where the bands would draw, would get, pile all their gear inside some kind of a...
You're describing my life.
Yeah, where they load up either the minibus or the minivan and they drive... 300,000 miles.
We had a pickup truck, yeah, with a topper that we filled all of the equipment in the back, just completely packed. And then the three of us would sit up front.
Roadie life was like that.
Oh, it was really fun, but it was also driving at 2 a.m, 3 a.m. after you've packed everything back up and trying to get home and this sort of thing was always fun, especially if you're a ways out of town to try to get back home by a reasonable hour. But I'll say my whole life since then has been, I still play, not professionally any longer. I sit in with a couple of bands that allow me to play. I mainly go to concerts and just listen to music. I still, when I was young, I had albums and you had no choice. There was no digital music, no streaming. So I had lots and lots and lots of LPs, like a wall of them. Now I have a wall of CDs. I still believe in buying the actual hard copy. It's not that I'm opposed to streaming music. It's just I like to own the physical copy of the.
Well, there's something about the magic of holding the medium in your hand and looking at it while you're listening to it that, for me, still holds. It's one of those mystical moments when I first discovered... what music, how it was put together. I mean, being able to flip over the side of the album and actually read who were the players, who was the producer, who arranged the song, who wrote the song. I mean, all of that physical piece for me, while I listened to something, connected for me.
So. I think I've talked enough about myself. I think we should turn the mic over to you, Lenny, and ask, I want to ask you, give me a little background of your place in music and why you absolutely love music so much. I mean, I certainly know it, but we should let our listeners have a taste of your musical interest.
My musical interest is probably so... I would say odd, but odd sounds wrong. It's diverse. I'll put it that way. And I have a love of virtually every type of music. And that comes from influence of my family background, growing up in New York City, being exposed to every type of of ethnic background from people who would come into my family's house.
So your Cuban background?
Cuban. So Jewish, Cuban, Eastern European influenced with the mixing pot of New York City and, frankly, the mixing pot of Cuba, which is probably one of the most diverse areas, both from the standpoint of different people who wanted to come to the United States but couldn't get there because of various reasons, and New York City, which then became the next stopping ground, and you'd have 170 different types of people and music, and so you'd be driving down one street and you'd hear one type of music blaring out of a car to another type of music, to a record store that specialized in Caribbean music, or a record store that specialized in Afro-Cuban music or bebop or jazz, or for that matter, rock and roll or country.
So what type of music was in your house? What type of music did your parents listen to that you were sort of absorbed?
So the first thing I remember is being about 3 years old and having my mother blasting, salsa music, Afro-Cuban bop, Dizzy Gillespie kind of, mixture, Mungo Santa Maria, kind of stuff. And I said, man, the energy and the excitement and the happiness.
So I got to ask, this is just an equipment question. Right. So obviously it's a stereo system. You got a turntable. Do you have big speakers, or do you just have these?
Mom had this big player in the living room. So it was the old big speakers on either side. It was the beginning of stereo, which leads me to where I got to influence them with my musical career with somebody else. But, they just started to arrive in people's houses where you'd have the two speakers on either side with a record player in the middle, where you'd have a place to store your records inside of it. But my mom had more records that could fit in there. So there's another part of the junkie of being a music addict, And so you would listen on it, but it would fill the house. It would fill the house. But interestingly enough, downstairs, so my family had a three-bedroom house, a three-family house, and downstairs there'd be a family playing a different type of music. So you literally had music choice as you went up or down the house, which was kind of cool also. So that was interesting, and it started me on this journey of opening my ears about different things. And that was really the first point of where I knew, like, I was just done. This was going to be something that I had to do, which then led me to trying to play. And man, I was convinced I was going to be the next whatever.
And weren't we all just convinced we were going to be like...
Especially because, it's like you said, the thing about you could get the guitar in the box, and pianos were accessible, and music instruments were accessible. It's not like now where the people are fighting for music in the classroom, which is just a horribly other story in terms of music education. But at the time, music was in the center of, as you said, your family made you take, for me, I wanted to take lessons. I wanted to learn how to play. And so I took piano lessons, took guitar lessons, and all of that. But
So I need to interject something. It's not that I didn't want to take piano lessons. It's just if I was going to play piano, I didn't want to play classical piano. So piano lessons for me was learning how to play Bach and Beethoven and Haydn and whatnot. And I can do that, but it's not what I wanted to do. Same thing when you learn how to play French horn. What you learn how to play is oom-pa-pa.
Yeah, I wanted to play Take Five. I wanted to be Dave Brubeck.
Right.
I wanted to, listening to, you know, that sort of Eddie Palmieri kind of, you know, driving beat, you know, the Palmieri brothers being able to play that kind of stuff, and you go, I want that. You know, I want to be able to do that. Or, you know, that first time we have that electric guitar of the Beatles, you know, where it goes, bam, right. It's, you know, a Hard Day's Night, right. or something like that, where you just go, or even Elvis, you know, and the great guitar player that that influenced Elvis and just passed the other day, played with Willie Nelson, just, you know, there was some, there's just some incredible people that would play. Glen Campbell was the one I was thinking about the second year. So you'd go, so here's just that potpourri of different types of people. And so, like you said, playing music for a kid was, go take these five different practice things. I'm going to play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star 400 times. And, you know, that's great, but that's not what I wanted to do, and that's not what I wanted to play. I wanted to, you know, so I remember at 10 years old making $5 performing in a band and let's say this is pretty damn cool, you know. Of course, I probably was and did suck, you know, I will admit, as a musician.
Which they got their money's worth, though.
Yeah, $5 at the time was probably a fortune, you know. But it led me to this, you know. So I'm taking these lessons and trying this, and I'm about 10 years old right after that gig, and show up my guitar teacher's, you know, thing in his basement, and I'm going, he says, so what did we learn today? Thinking that I'm going to learn some cool song, he says, we got to stop. I said, what do you mean we got to stop? He said, I really got to tell you something. It's, you know, I got some good news and some bad news for you, dude. I'm going, I'm 10 years old. How does someone say you've got good news and bad news? I was like, so what's the bad news? He said, you suck. And I was like, I was crushed. I was absolutely crushed. I knew that my dream of actually being an on-stage star was done. I was over with. I figured I might as well just, you know, walk out the door. So he said, okay, before I, you know, cry in my Cheerios or whatever, I said, what's the good news? He says, well, the good news is you actually have one of the better ears I've ever heard from music, you know, for somebody that understands music. I said, okay, what does that mean? He handed me a piece of paper. I'm going, my reward is a piece of paper?
You got an ear.
I guess my ear is a piece of paper. So I go home to my mom, and I'm despondent. I'm just beyond upset. And she looks at me, and, you know, she actually, fortunately for me, she knew what was up. So I walked in the house, and she saw me, and I said, and she said, how was the music lesson? I said, it was terrible, terrible. I was crying. He said, I'm never going to play. He says, well, what's in your hand? I said, well, he gave me something. I said, have you looked at it? I said, no, I looked at it. I'm pissed. And she says, well, look at it. And I look at it, and it's an address. It's an address in Manhattan. And it says, tomorrow, 4:00. And I'm going, and she says, well, are you going? I said, well, can I go? And, you know, unfortunately, at this time, still in New York City, you know, it's still pretty safe for a kid to take the subway by themselves and all that. And I used to do that for school and stuff like that. So I go into Manhattan, 4:00, get up at 57th and 6th Avenue at the subway stop. I'm standing in front of the address, and there is the Steinway showroom. Glistening, ebony, black pianos. I mean, it was heaven. It was heaven.
It still is.
Yeah, exactly. But for me, it was a kid in a candy store, so to speak. And I'm looking at these things, but I'm looking inside and I'm going, oh, but it's the 10th floor. But there's no way to go upstairs at all. So I go inside and I ask the guy, and he says, oh, you got to go through the store all the way to the back to the freight elevator. I'm going, okay, so I'm walking through the store, going up to the freight elevator. You know, the elevator operator takes me up to the 10th floor, opens up this steel cage elevator, and big elevator, so, you know, like a fit pianos and other stuff like that. I don't know where I'm going. Get up there, and there's a tiny little door, entrance door, it seems like, and this big door on the side to get in. Tiny little sign says, Nola Sound Studio. I get my eyes open up and go, what the heck? Where am I? And I open up the door, crabby old beehived lady looking at me. What do you want? I'm shaking the paper. I'm 10 years old. I go, and she says, okay, sit down in the corner. Spend an hour sitting in the corner. She does with go home. Go home to my mom. She says, how was it? I said, it was horrible. I had to sit in the corner for an hour like I was in a principal's office. Like I did something wrong. He said, is this my punishment for stinking as a musician? She said, are you going back? I said, well, can I? She says, yeah. So I go back every week for a month. She says, okay, here's a mop. Go clean the bathroom.
Got to start at the bottom.
Man, oh man, I have to tell you, bottom, I was in the freaking sewer, in the sewer. So I'm cleaning the bathroom for 2 more months, still showing up.
Did you graduate to coffee yet?
No, I didn't even get, I did, well, actually, it's funny that you said that. So 3 months later, the door opens, they come in, and this guy rips open the door. He says, are you the kid that won't go away? I said, yeah. And he says, come with me. And he takes me through the door. And it's like I'm in heaven. In front of me is these pictures that I've seen only in the pictures from the Sinatra Capitol Session years. It's a studio like no studio could ever possibly imagine. It's practically 3/4 of the floor of the building. And off to the side are 7 open reel-to-reel console tape recorders and this board that's pristine, and these cables that are pristine. And I'm going, I hear the angels singing. I'm going, I've arrived, and wherever I am, and I'm not leaving. That was Les Paul that opened the door and opened my eyes to where I really found where I was going to go somewhere and be something. And an influence, it changed my trajectory of my life because I realized that if I could just stick it out and persevere, I might actually be able to utilize whatever God gave me for hearing and understanding and turn into something that I could. Because I couldn't create, what I could hear in my mind, I couldn't play. But if I could communicate that or translate that to someone else, it could become my involvement in the creative process.
So you were, what, 10, 11 years old?
I was like maybe 11.
Yeah, so my defining moment came a little bit later. I was in, I'm going to say 7th grade, maybe 8th grade, which had been 69. So I was a little old. I was about 14, 13 years old. And I discovered in the junk drawer of the kitchen this little case in the very, very back. And this is my harmonica story. So I found a little case, and it was a marine band case. And I don't know if you remember
the old case.
You flip it up, you know, and it's sort of a hard cardboard printed marine band. And it was my mom's marine band harmonica.
Why'd your mom have a marine band harmonica?
Well, so why did she have a bugle? I mean, she had this, and she didn't play any other instruments. And so she just had this marine band harmonica. I picked it up. And didn't know any better, so I just started trying to play it. I had never played one before, and I was able to pick out a tune. I think it was Old Susanna.
Oh, I thought it was Whammy Jammer.
No, that was many years later. But the, you know, being able to pick out a song, she walks in, she goes, you can play harmonica. And I said, no, I just picked this up. I don't know what I'm doing. She goes, no, you can play harmonica. I didn't realize that most people pick up harmonica have no clue as how to, like, pick out a song and tune or anything, and I was able to do it immediately. It was the first instrument that I actually just fell in love with, in terms of that I had total control over and didn't need lessons, although I kind of wish I did get some lessons on how to do some tongue action on blocking and whatnot, which is upper-level techniques, but I can play pretty well. And so I almost immediately after that, I had never had any blues albums in my collection. And I just went to, you know, record stores and said, who's got harmonica blues, you know, albums? And I sort of picked up, you know, Canned Heat and Paul Butterfield and Muddy Waters. And I learned about, you know, Little Walter and Big Walter Horton. And just, I mean, you know, so John Mayall.
I was about to say, so this was late 60s?
This is 67, 68. So
right at the heart of that that formation with the Butterfield Blues Band.
And the resurgence of old blues. Old blues albums were just coming back because of the resurgence of all that. And so, honestly, from that moment on, I did not not have a harmonica in my pocket for the next probably 5 years. I mean, it's like it was always with me. I played it when I'd walk to school. I'd play harmonica the whole way to school. Trying to figure out how to bend notes, how to play what I hear on albums. And again, it's not like you can take classes in harmonica, you know, that they're offering at the local college or anything. It just doesn't exist. So it was one of those things that as soon as you learn how to play it, some band says, you can play harmonica? Come over here. And so
you can play harmonica, you're ready, we're playing guitar for a while, you were singing also. Yep. Did you put the three together for yourself in the band when you were in Germany?
Yes, I did, actually. So that was the whole thing, is I began writing songs, blues songs, and I would write them on guitar.
Right.
I'd sing them. Some of them were in German, some of them were in English. It was very interesting to write a German blues song because you have to rhyme in German, which is all kind of weird.
What does that feel like? I love my Wiener Schnitzel. I love it all day long.
That's in English. Believe me, it's tougher in German just because you have to remember that the verbs come at the end. So when you're singing. But I played harmonica. I never played guitar with that band because we already had two guitarists. We had two guitarists, a bass player, and a drummer, and then me. And so we didn't need a third guitar. I did a little piano work, but we never played on stage with piano because I didn't own a portable keyboard. So where we practice, I'd play piano with it, but we never took it on the road because we just didn't have the capability of traveling with that sort of stuff. I was pretty much I had my acoustic guitar with me and my harmonicas, and I remember every place we'd play, we'd have to break up the cash between five of us, so I didn't get a lot of money each gig. It was enough to buy two more harmonicas pretty much each time, so I ended up with a whole batch of harmonicas from Germany. And you need them just because that allows you to play in different keys. Because basically... And that's why you have a harmonica belt with eight harmonicas or ten harmonicas on it. So we're switching from, you know, A to B, you know, E to F, you know, it's great. So, but that picking up a harmonica just changed my performance life. I realized at that point I needed to perform. I mean, I'd already been performing a lot as a kid, just doing musicals in church choirs, playing guitar, acoustic guitar in front of people. I've always done that sort of stuff. And it's never been a problem, you know, although I will say the first time I ever performed a musical was when I was about 4 years old, and my sister, you know, dragged me to somebody else's house, and I sang my part.
You still have emotional scars about that, don't you?
I do. But it was... I sang, I think, all my parts from behind a couch or behind a chair or something, so they couldn't see me. I had such stage fright. But I got over that as they...
So this is sort of like the first concert when I showed him Van Morrison, where he faced away from the audience for the whole thing and stuff like that.
Do you think he had stage fright?
Well...
Or was he just being, like, you know, antisocial?
No, I think... Well, there's a lot of that. That's probably a great story for another time. But... I think that the interesting thing for me, being part of what I would call the foundation of a performance where you're putting the microphones in place for a band to play and setting that up and everything else was the part for me that was not frightening at all. And even the live performance where you got four, we were talking about this a while ago, but you have five or six different things that you had to mix together. One was the combination of, for the audience that was sitting there in the club, and you'd have to do that, to then the mix of what the band members would need to hear in their own, you know, speakers in front of them, to the mix of something that you'd record. I remember, I know that you know that you had an opportunity to do this. I remember being in Long Island with the Ramones, and it was early. It was really early in their career. I want to say it was, I think the place was OBI, Ocean Beach Inn. And it was a
Long Island.
Long Island. It was a crappy club at the time that then became, in the later 70s, a disco club kind of thing. I remember being in the club, and I remember these guys talking to me about, you know, what they each wanted to hear differently. And they were looking at me because I'm not the same age, or maybe a little bit, you know, younger or whatever. And looking at me, sort of wondering how the hell I'm going to do this. Because,
well, with the Ramones, you can't, because it's just one solid. I mean, and usually, and I saw them at the Rat, and I think the stage was about 8 feet wide.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy. And they're playing so loud, and the audience wants them to play loud, and you're trying to pick out. So this was a great thing from, you know, you talk about, you know, when I was, you know, being trained in the beginning with Les, and then coming flash forward to that sort of a moment where you have so many different things happen at the same time, and I just found that I could focus and slice that. And that's where I recognized I could take that and carry that forward into so many later experiences in life, whether I was doing that music for television or for jazz or for even for classical music or stuff like that, where you have an orchestra of 40, 50, 60 people, and you got to be able to make each musician have what they need so that they could perform both for the audience and for the recording. That was...
And I want to explore that some later date in terms of miking orchestra, because that's a tough thing.
That's surgery. That's,
yeah, I know.
That's almost as hard as brain surgery kind of thing. you talk about that. That can be complex.
So I don't think I have any direct questions. We've skipped around a lot. In terms of both our backgrounds, our lives, I guess the only real story is how the hell do we meet? I don't know if that's whether we want to get into the long run or the short run of this, but
I just will say that there was that moment where we chose to do a musical playoff against each other for 7 hours instead of go drinking. Now we've learned how to drink and do that.
It's an acquired skill.
Apparently, I didn't have the skill yet. But, you know, I did. It was amazing to me that someone other than me had that much music that was similar yet different enough that you could... You know, I think I remember it was like you started playing something, and I was thinking to myself, oh, I've got something that's similar but different enough. And just say, hold on, listen to this. And then you'd look at me and you'd go, nah, wait a second, listen to this. And I don't think we've repeated a song in 7 hours.
Oh, no. Well, we both, just to let the listeners know, we both have about a couple hundred. You know, gig of music.
Well, I think we have a lot more than that now.
On each of our own laptops, and they don't overlap completely. But it was very interesting to go through our sort of musical backgrounds by playing music we like, and having to recognize that, you know, Lenny or myself knew the music, appreciate it, and said, "Oh, you haven't heard this though," and it was like another version of it, or a different track, or a different artists, that, and it was quite fascinating. And now when we combined our music together, that's another whole story.
You know, and you know, you say that, so you know, somebody who wrote a song and the seven different versions that came out or recorded as a result of that, or the guy who wrote the song and performed it but didn't become the hit.
Yep.
And instead became somebody else discovered that, you know. So I think Kris Kristofferson wrote a lot of songs, but he probably only ever had one in his whole life.
One hit, but it
was a big one. But
it was a big one, and certainly Janis Joplin made it much bigger.
Okay, that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of Music Matters. Hope you enjoyed the show. Please keep your ears open for our next podcast, where Walden and Lenny will be discussing... Well, you never really know, so you're just going to have to tune in and find out. Once again, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Carboy Wines. Thank you again for listening, and remember, all music matters. Take care.
I have a great idea for post-production.